Hey, and welcome to the RUP podcast. I'm James Roycroft Davis, and I founded this podcast after I recently found myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did, because I started talking about how I felt. This podcast features mostly men's stories about getting into a rut and what it was like being there, but most importantly, how they got out of it.
In this episode of The RUP, I sit down with one of golf's leading high-performance mindset coaches, Carl Morris. Carl has worked with some of golf's biggest names, including Darren Clarke, Lee Westwood and Louis Estes, as well as cricketers Michael Vaughan and rugby league's Huddersfield Giants. Carl's insight into the psychology of high performance and its link with mental health issues is fascinating. And we discuss a range of topics, including the personality traits of highly successful athletes that may simultaneously lead to mental health issues. We also discuss the process he goes through to identify early on whether one of his clients may be getting into a rut and how he supports them and whether a golfer's relationship with money affects their performance. It's a truly fascinating episode. And I'm already looking forward to the next time I get to sit down with Carl to dive even deeper into this subject.
Carl, welcome to The RUP. How are you?
Thanks, James. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to the chat.
Yeah, second time lucky as well. For people who don't know, we've already recorded and the quality was so poor, my fault entirely, that we've re-recorded. And actually, I'm quite glad we're going to re-record because... it's given me an opportunity to think of more very interesting things to talk to you about.
We get a second serve.
Right, let's dive straight in. This is obviously a podcast on men's mental health, but in your role as a high performance coach, mindset coach, you'll work predominantly with golfers and athletes in general. Do you want to just set the scene in terms of a bit about your career and who you've worked with in the past?
Yeah, I mean, my career, James, was originally as a golfer, wanted to be a top player and was pretty promising as a junior, and then a pattern started to emerge whereby I was excellent in practice situations, but not so good when it really counted in big tournaments and big events. And I first of all started to look at all the technical things that I could work on and tried to perfect the golf swing and find all the answers in mechanics, and that really didn't work out. It just perpetuated the same problem, and I became more and more interested in the performance side of things, and I actually stopped playing for a while and went away and studied various approaches, hypnosis, NLP, cognitive behavioral therapy, a whole bunch of different things in a game of golf, and just a real wide variety of areas that I looked at, mindfulness, all that kind of stuff, and then came back and started to work initially more with people trying to help them change habits, you know, just standard things like wanting to maybe eat better or stop smoking or drink less or whatever the usual stuff that we're all challenged with as human beings. And that was an interesting journey. And then I came back into golf and got lucky with a couple of players who I worked with who did pretty well. And then it just went on from there. I worked with Darren Clarke and he won a world championship event. And then Graham McDell came along, and you know, been lucky to work with four or five major winners over the years. And 20 odd years further on down the line, was still exploring and still trying to find ways of improving performance and you know, looking at the role that the mind plays in sport, because we know it's so relevant, but you know, people talk so much about the relevance of the mind. What do they actually do to work on it? And I think, you know, I'm pretty clear on it now. It's the mind is no different than your diet or your fitness training. You've got to attend to its own health. If you kind of leave it be and hope for the best, you know, you can get into some issues. But you know, we know so much more about it now. There's been so much, for instance, mindfulness. There's been so many studies done about the benefit of that. And you know, I think it You know, looking at the situation that we're all in now, we're all going to be challenged going forward with the way the world has changed in the past few months. And resilience is going to be a huge factor in whether people get through and come out the other side and flourish.
You talked about this transition away from playing golf to becoming a high performance mindset coach. What is it about? What is it about the mindset that fascinated you back then?
I think it was just that, you know, my own experience of seeing a capability in one environment that didn't come out in another, and then I started to see so much more of that in other people. You know, classically, golfers good on the range but not being able to perform under what we perceive as pressure, and you know, just became more and more interested in what was going on with that and what could we actually do about it. You know, I think, you know, years ago people would say either you've got it or you've not, and I never took that on board really. I thought, you know, surely that we can learn some skills, we can learn to develop skills that get us through in situations that make us feel uneasy. You know, you look at some of the problems that people have, the phobias that people have about, for instance, public speaking, you know, that hold a lot of people back in their careers because they don't want to present their ideas in front of an audience. And, you know, they can have all this great content, all these great things that they could share with people, but maybe the fear of presenting in public can hold them back so much. And that, I think, is a shame. I think it's, you know, when you look at the human condition, what are we here for? What we're trying to do? Surely we should be trying to get to the best version of ourselves, not for anybody else, but for our own sort of self-actualization. And if you've got some capability and you've got a gift in a certain area, but because of maybe the way you think about it, it isn't being allowed to come out, I think that's a real shame. And I think, you know, this kind of things that, you know, you're doing and talking about these things now, that when we go to the other extreme as well, and you see the pathology of, you know, depression and anxiety and, you know, suicidal tendencies and things like that, I think when you go the other side and you can give people hope and you can say that there's a future out there that could be better, if you can look at the way that your mind works and, you know, take some steps to get better at it and think of it no different than, as I said before, about training. You train in the gym to get a fitter, stronger, healthier body. Why don't we look at the mind in just the same way? Because there is stuff out there that you can do now.
You've also worked with other sportsmen in other sports. Mm. In another call, you've mentioned how you've worked with the Ashes 05 team, in particular Michael Vaughan and Huddersfield Giants, right? Mm-hmm. What are the differences between athletes in those sports as opposed to golf? And what was it also like working with the Ashes 05 team and Huddersfield Giants?
I mean, I didn't work with the Ashes team as such. I just worked with a couple of players, but in particular, Michael Vaughan, sure. I was asked to work with on a one-to-one basis, which was a fascinating study during that time. I mean, billed as the greatest test series of all time, I look back now and pinch myself and think that, you know, to a very, very tiny degree, I was involved in Absolutely. Some way on that. You know, I still get the videos out of those incredible matches, and, you know, the match where we were two runs away from sort of going 2-0 down, and it would have been a very different story. And you see, you know, you look back on those things and you see how sport can hinge on a single ball or a single kick or a single putt or whatever. And you know, people, the trajectory of people's careers can hang so finely in balance. But, you know, what Michael Vaughan was brilliant at, and I learned so much from him, that he was wonderful in creating an environment for his players where they were allowed to flourish. You know, he had some great characters in that team, Freddie Flintoff and Kevin Peterson, but he facilitated an environment that allowed them to go out and express themselves. And I think that is one of the most important areas to look at in performance, is what environments do you create? If you're a coach or a leader or a captain or whatever, what does the environment look like? Does it allow people to flourish? And if there's one thing that I've found, and it's not like I've split the atom by coming up with this, it's that, you know, you're dealing with infinite variety of unique human beings, that everybody is different. Everybody's so different. And I think, you know, just chucking messages at the wall and hoping it sticks for everybody is not going to happen. And I think, you know, great coaches, great leaders, great business people do instinctively understand the inherent difference that we all have. And I think human beings respond to people when they speak to people who they feel are trying to understand them as people, understand them as humans.
You mentioned the environment a few times. Well, what kind of environment did he create?
I think he created an environment of freedom rather than fear. If you look back prior to the success of the England cricket team, this was prior to central contracts and things like that, and it started to change. But I think primarily, you know, for a long time with English cricket, you were kind of the players were so on edge because there was so many changes in personnel. You played a couple of matches and out you went, and on to the next one, and you know, next bowler comes in, next batter comes in. And I know for a fact that he created an environment where he said to players, go and express yourself. I am not going to say anything to you about playing a false shot or whatever if you're going out there trying to express your ability. It's not being stupid or reckless, but you know, I want you to play knowing that it's more about the expression freedom of your own ability rather than always thinking about the consequences of what I'm going to say as captain or what the selectors are going to say. So I think to a large degree, that was his great legacy. He created an environment of freedom rather than fear.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I want to move on to talking about mental health issues within golf, actually. You've worked with some incredibly successful people, some amazing athletes. What kind of personality traits did these incredibly successful athletes have, which often would simultaneously lead to them struggling with their mental health?
I think, sort of contradicting what I've just said about the individual, but we kind of need to generalize when we have conversations like this. I think the element that you would pick with most successful people, or a lot of successful people, is a single-minded, obsessive nature to the personality, that they, you know, they become obsessed with getting to wherever they feel they want to. They become obsessed with their craft. They become obsessed with maximizing their ability and harnessed in the right way. You know, that gets them up in the morning. That gets them training. That gets them working on the game. That gets them passionately involved in seeing how good they can become. Taken too far, as we perhaps all know, when your whole identity is wrapped up in how many runs you score, or what your golf score is, or whether you won the tennis match, when your whole identity as a human being is based on the results in sport, that can be a very vulnerable place, because sport is inherently unpredictable. Life is inherently unpredictable, as we've all just experienced. So I think when too much of you is involved as a whole entity in your results in sport, that can start to get a little bit dangerous. You know, I'm reminded of some of the things that I know that I've read about Tiger Woods, that, you know, one of the things that it was always reinforced to him that if Tiger had had a bad day on the golf course, Tiger the golfer had had a bad day on the golf course, that didn't reflect on Tiger the person, the human being. There was a very, very well-known coach in golf going back in the 70s and 80s, a performance coach, a guy called Chuck Hogan. And he talked a lot about how we need to play sport from what he called a safe place, in the sense that he talked about getting people to really, really understand that your value as a human being is not dependent on what a golf ball does or a rugby ball does or a cricket ball does. Your value as a human being is a given. Your value as a sports person is always going to be a little bit, results come and go, that there's the inherent variability in sport. So, you know, attaching too much of your ego to the outcome of a sport can be dangerous. And, you know, we've seen that so many times. So I think the real greats and the ones who stay around for a long time, you know, I'm thinking in my sport, in golf, somebody like Bernard Langer, you know, who's an incredible man. He's still playing, you know, he's cleaned up on the Champions Tour, the Seniors Tour in America. He's in his mid-60s and he could still win on the main tour. And he has a sereneness about him, Bernard, because, you know, he's a man of faith. But I think deep down he realizes that his value as a human being is not dependent on what a golf ball does. So it's he's always been on a quest to see how good he can be at the game. But underneath it, there's a balanced perspective on the whole thing that is, as I say, his value is not just about what he does on a golf course.
That's fantastic. When you're in that situation with a golfer who has put themselves in that place where actually their identity is attached to their success on the golf course, what do you even do to remove them from that place? How do you deal with that?
What you do is hold up a mirror, in the sense that, you know, and I fell into this trap that you know, the classic thing with a golfer, you know, rugby player, cricketer, wherever it is, if you look at how it works, is that, you know, we start to play golf because we like it, because dad plays or friends play or whatever, and you hit some shots and wow, that feels really good to just see a ball launch up into the air. You get a thrill from the actual game itself, and you get more and more involved in it, and you get better and you improve and you take lessons. And all of a sudden, as you go down that route, at some point then, if you're successful, you start to get accolades, you start to get people telling you how good you are. You start to get strokes for your ego, and you can get drawn into what I call this for that, that you end up playing golf today for something that you think it's going to give you in the future. So then you fall into the trap of not playing the game anymore. You're playing the game for what it will potentially give you. And I think just especially with younger players, just to hold up that mirror sometimes and think, ask the person, have you fallen into this trap here that you're not playing your sport anymore, you're playing a game for something that you think it might give you in the future? You know, I had Luke Sutton on my podcast a while ago, a cricketer who'd written a very, very honest appraisal of his challenges with depression and drink and things like that. And he talked about how, you know, when he's advising young cricketers now, when they're sort of getting down this line where the success is apparent and contracts are being offered and things like that, you know, he talks about just occasionally just go back to your roots. Just go back to the first cricket club that you played at and the people that you surrounded yourself with as a kid, where it was just you were playing for the inherent joy of hitting a cricket ball or bowling fast or catching or whatever it is. And it's not an easy thing to do, but a long-winded answer to your question, James, is that, you know, hold up a mirror and just get people to sort of see, are you falling into this trap here of losing sight of the fact that it's a sport that you play, a sport that you love, and now it's all about what that sport might give you in the future. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be ambitious, and I'm not saying we shouldn't try and be world number one or win majors or play for England or whatever. That's fantastic. But to keep a balance and understand, to actually give yourself the best chance of doing that, is to remain in love with the game itself, not what the game's going to give you at some point in the future.
What's the most, I suppose, common psychological problem you find in golf by professional golfers?
I think from a performance perspective, one of the things that does get in the way an awful lot with golf, probably more than most sports, is over analysis, you know, technical, really getting so technical about the movements that you make. And when you're trying to dissect it in minute detail about where your elbows should be and your hips should be. And as we understand, you know, from a learning perspective, the brain-body connection doesn't really work well when we've what we call a very internal focus. If you're internally focused and telling your body how to move, the research would suggest that's not probably the best way to do it. You know, the brain likes in the ballpark ideas, not precise details. You know, and there's so much good research now about the difference between internal focus and external focus. So in golf, are you thinking about what your body's doing, or are you thinking a bit more about how you want the golf club to move and what you want the golf ball to do? And the research is pretty solid that for most people, an external focus is far more efficient than an internal focus. So I've seen many careers ruined, natural players who achieved a certain amount and then decided that they needed to change all the technique and became very, very obsessed with how they moved and what the swing looked like and things like that. And just got absolutely tied in knots with all of that.
I suppose it's also counterintuitive to think like that as well, because you're conditioned from an early age. I played golf when I was younger, but not at all anymore. But to learn the technicality of the sport, to learn how the golf club swings through your body and where your elbow goes, to then transitioning actually to just allowing that to flow is incredibly counterintuitive. And I suppose that's a real problem for golfers.
It is. And yet when you think about other things that we've learned to do well, I mean, most people listening or watching to your podcast, I would imagine, have managed to negotiate the skill of brushing their teeth this morning. I would imagine most people got through that quite well. Well, if you think about how you learn to brush your teeth, you know, did you learn to brush your teeth by rotating your elbow over a fixed axis? Or did you learn to brush your teeth by learning how to use the brush? Well, we learn to use the brush rather than directing what our body's doing. You know, you learn to use a car not by rocking your shoulders from side to side and keeping your hips still. You learn to operate the wheel. So, you know, these simple ideas of you know, I often, when I'm working with players, ask the question, what's your attention on? And get people to really understand what are they paying attention to when they're trying to play the sport. And 9 times out of 10, if they're suffering from a performance drop, it's because their attention is in an area that's not that productive for them. They've got too much involved about how the body's moving. They've got too technical. And very often a light bulb can go on when it's a little bit more about the outcome of the shot or what they want the golf club to do. And it kind of frees them up. So again, it's this fascinating area of attention, of what are you paying attention to? You know, I pretty much sum up the stuff that I do. My work is about that single word, because, you know, whether it's getting better at golf or football or cricket, it's pretty much what you put your attention on. If you're looking at being happy in life and successful in life and content, again, it's about what you choose to put your attention on a regular basis. And we develop habitual patterns of attention. You know, if you're, people say to me, you know, why do people get angry? Well, people get angry because they get angry. They get good at being angry because their attention is drawn to things that trigger them, that make them angry. And, you know, when you can actually recognize some of these patterns, then you're at a choice point that you can think, well, I've put my attention on this thing for so long that's made me miserable and unhappy. Well, could I choose to put my attention? It's no different from hitting better golf shots to living a more fulfilled life.
You're pretty big on mindfulness, and actually, not just in golf, but this is relative to people who are just going by their day-to-day business. But the power of being present, and it sounds like from what you're saying, that's one of the biggest factors here, which is not worrying about the future or being sad about the past or even worrying about the past, but being present. How powerful is mindfulness within golf? I can imagine it's extraordinarily powerful.
I think it's extraordinarily powerful in life, James. I think anybody, any time that you've performed well, or any time that you've been happy and content, I would pretty much guarantee you'll have been present. You know, even you could look at it at the most simplest of things, of having a conversation with somebody.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times when we have conversations with somebody, we're not present to that conversation. We're inside of our heads waiting for what we're going to say next rather than listening to the person in front of us. So, you know, I think the whole idea of being present, you know, we've got this incredible gift as human beings that, as far as we're aware, other creatures don't have, that we have the capability to reflect on the past and project into the future. Now, that is why we've one of the reasons why we've evolved in front of other creatures, because we have that capability to imagine a better future. We have that capability to learn from the past. Unfortunately, as humans, we fall into the trap of doing neither, that we don't reflect on the past in a way that's productive for us. We perhaps dwell a little bit too much on things that have gone wrong, and then we project into a future and create all kinds of Armageddon scenarios about what may or may not happen. So, you know, mindfulness can seem a bit left field and a bit, you know, flowery, but actually the science is solid on it, and it's just about, can you bring your attention to what it is that you are doing right here and now?
And I mean, everybody's mindfulness day to day.
Yeah, you know, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to sit on a mountain in India with your legs crossed to understand this. You know, even simple things like deciding that today, if you've got a bunch of things to do, if you're going to write an article, you know, decide that you're going to be with that article for a period of time, not start that and then go somewhere else. And unfortunately, the biggest challenge that we've all got is that we are in an environment where every single thing every day is virtually challenging the ability to stay present, because we've got a phone beeping at us constantly. We've got news flashes all over the place. Everything to a mindful state of mind is being challenged by the modern world. So I think, you know, to have a practice, a daily practice where you, you know, you decide to take a period of time of the day to sit or stand and have an anchor point, be that your breath or a mantra or whatever you choose, and you pay attention to that on purpose and notice how your mind keeps wandering, but you bring it back. And that's the key with this, is noticing how your mind wanders and then having the ability to bring it back. And then that in you know, I think does transfer over. Then you're better at paying attention to this putt. You're better attention at paying to this ball that's coming at you. You have a better attention to looking at what the ball's doing on a rugby field. You know, and all of the simplest things that people say, you know, in cricket, just watch the ball. You know, it sounds such a simple thing, but it's hard to watch the ball coming at you if your mind's somewhere else. If it's still stuck on the fact that you got a duck in the last match, and it's still stuck in the idea that if you get out today, you're going to get dropped. So, what sounds incredibly simple actually requires a commitment to a daily practice. So, I think, you know, mindfulness is a simple concept, but a challenging thing to actually do. But you know, I don't see any downside to it, really. I don't see any downside to being a bit more present on a daily basis as often as you can be.
No, really. I agree. Whilst depression and anxiety isn't really your area of expertise, and I appreciate that, but I can imagine you may have worked with one or two athletes in your career who have been suffering from depression or anxiety, probably more anxiety as to what's to come, when maybe they've missed the cut, etc. Hypothetically speaking, let's take an athlete who is very anxious about what's to come on the golf course or in life that you're working with. What kind of stuff would you, what kind of techniques would you run through with them? What would you try and get them to do to move them away from this anxious state and into a state of being present?
Yeah. I think, one strong tool, James, is perspective. You know, there was a great story, a lady I know well, who's been a very successful coach, Pia Nielsen, a Swedish lady, genius of a coach. She wrote some wonderful, wonderful golf books that can be applied to life. She worked with the greatest woman golfer of all time, Annika Sorenstam. And she tells a story early on in Annika's career that she was going out in the final round of the Women's Open, US Women's Open. And Annika was really nervous. Really anxious, and Pia said to her, you know, she said, if you can look at where you are today, because I think they were playing at a course in New York, and she said to her, you know, if you could float out of this situation now, and you looked at it, and you saw that all the people that you knew would today matter, and she said, yeah, it would matter to me. He said, well, what about if you floated out a little bit further and you actually looked at the whole state of New York, and we were just here in this golf course today, and then you know, you looked at it and you said, well, does what you do today really, really matter today? And she's still hung on to it. And then eventually, you know, they got to the point where, so if you could actually look down on the world of all the things going on in the world today, does what you do on a golf course really matter that much? And she eventually cracked up laughing and smiled, and it kind of released the tension bubble. So, I think perspective is a massive assist in this. That, you know, Tim Galway talked years ago about, you know, look at what's the worst that can happen and what's the best that can happen. And, you know, what's the worst that could happen in that situation in golf? You know, you take a high score and, yeah, you feel terrible for a day, but a week later it's gone. And even the upside of it, that if you win, you know, I've worked with, you know, been fortunate to work with major players, and, you know, I have seen them a couple of weeks after winning major events, and you'd think if you won a major, you'd be happy for the rest of your days and nothing would ever get in your way. And that's just not the case. You know, life does still keep throwing stuff at you afterwards. So understanding that, you know, your perspective on it is so hugely important. You know, it's almost shattering the illusion of it, really, of how important it actually is, and then recreate the illusion that, you know, you know it really doesn't matter, but you want to pretend that it does. And it seems a complete paradox, that, but I think when you can do that, you set yourself free to perform, you set yourself free to play a little bit more.
Very interesting. How do golfers use you? What I mean by that question, are you walking around the golf course with them? Are you walking around the golf course with them? Are you debriefing them after their rounds? What's the relationship like?
Again, it varies a lot, James. Really, I mean, you know, if I sort of describe the best way, I think I'm utilized is where people get me on board and I get to observe them in the actual environment. So I get to actually watch them play and see how they perform, see what some of the patterns are and the habits are. And then, you know, we come up with a plan. I usually work with players over at least a 12-month period, because I'm not into sort of quick fixes. You know, it's a program of improvement. And what I do think, and this would be my recommendation for anybody listening to or watching your podcast, is have somebody who you're accountable to, whatever your goals are. And it doesn't have to be a paid coach. It doesn't have to be, but, you know, have somebody that you're accountable to, somebody that you have to write an email to each week to tell them how you've got on, somebody that will pick the phone up and speak to you once a month or something like that, where you can actually just stay on track with things. Because I think that's the real, real value, you know, of a coach, that they provide that neutral sounding board, but they also provide an accountability to what you're doing. Because, you know, we all need that. We, you know, if you're going to be successful at anything, whether it's, you know, getting stronger or winning at golf or whatever, the only way you're going to be successful, as far as I can see, is if you put enough good days together, if you do enough things on a daily basis that accumulate over time. Now, that simple principle, accumulating good days, is incredibly challenging to stay on track with. You know, we get diverted, yeah. Life takes over, we don't feel like doing it today or whatever, you know.
It's massive.
Moon's in the wrong position or whatever it may be. But I think if you've got somebody that you're accountable to, that you know you're going to have to send them an email at the end of the week, and you know there's a phone conversation coming, I think that is a hugely, hugely valuable and important thing that you can set up. You know, you don't, as I say, you can set that up with some people that you know. I don't necessarily think it works well with close friends or, you know, partners and things like that, but I think if you can get somebody on board who's neutral to your situation, that you have to be accountable to them, I think, you know, you can literally change your life in 6 months by just setting up some kind of accountability with somebody.
Mm. There's an awful lot of money swashing around golf.
There was.
Well, there was, yeah. How does money affect a golfer's performance? I think we touched on it when we had a chat last time, that the psychology of making the cut, both obviously on a performance and financially. how does money affect performance?
I think you know, we can't dismiss that. It's you know, especially for guys who have not got any money, you know, don't let's not dismiss that, you know, if you're out there and you've got no money and you're playing tournaments and it's costing you a few thousand each week, and you know, it's okay. Somebody saying, like, say, oh, the cut, missing the cut doesn't matter. There's always next week. There's a very real financial issue to that.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
You know, you can't dismiss that. But I think it comes back to, again, how somebody trains, you know, and how good they are at. Yeah, we know we want to make the cut, and we know we want to make some money, but focusing on that probably isn't going to create that. So how good could you be on focusing on things that actually are under your control that would contribute to you making the cut, that would contribute to you winning money? And I think that's what the best players have the ability to do, that there's all this noise around of finance and accolade and all the rest of it, but they're very, very good. You know, ultimately it sounds simplistic, but probably the best thing that you could ever do to make the cut is make sure that you're completely immersed, back to being present again, that you're completely immersed in this shot, in this moment. And when that shot's gone, you're immersed in the next shot and then the next shot. And again, these sound simple things, but they you know, they need training, they need support, they need accountability. But you know, that for me, you know, and when people start making a lot of money, I think that can be a potential trap as well. You know, as you say, there's been unbelievable wealth knocking around in the game, and you know, that changes some people, and that can be
in
a drive.
What ways?
I think you start to see what's out there and what's available, and all the trinkets come to you, and the, you know, the money, the cars, the houses, and all the rest of it, and you know, some people are clearly affected by that, and not always in a positive way, because again, that can then fall into the trap of playing, as I mentioned earlier on, this for that. You're playing golf for something that's going to give you in the future in terms of finance. But I think, you know, I think we're, again, back to the real greats of the game. You know, Rory McIlroy is just obsessed with getting better at golf. Now, as a consequence of that, he wins millions and millions of dollars. You know, yes, that's, you could argue, you could flip the coin on and say it's okay, Rory being obsessed with golf when he's got million-dollar contracts and all the rest of it, and he's all the money in the FedEx championships and all. But I don't think Rory at any point has ever lost his obsession with the game of golf. He loves the game. You listen to Rory talk, and he's very knowledgeable about the history of the game. He's very tuned into what he can do to improve himself. He's very thoughtful in terms of, I know he's read a lot on, again, mindfulness and stoicism and all these kind of things. So, you know, I think deep down, Rory McIlroy's passion is golf, the game of golf, and how can I improve at the game of golf? And guess what? Because of that obsession with getting better at the game of golf, the world rewards him with infinite, you know, money and fame and all the rest of it. But he's never lost sight of the game itself.
Let's talk a bit more about Rory McIlroy. He famously capitulated, wasn't it the Open, in 2012?
No, the Masters.
Talk us through what might be going through a golfer's mind when that kind of thing is happening to them. And also how you as a coach can help or prevent that from happening.
I'm not sure you can prevent it, James. I think what you know classically happened with Rory was he was in a position to win the Masters, and you know on started to really struggle on the final day. And we remember the shot he hit on 10 where he knocked it nearly in the house on the left hand side, and really, really struggled. And I think in those situations that the mind starts racing and you don't really know what's happening, and you know, panic sets in, and it's a tough game in that situation when you're laid bare and your emotions are running riot and you're losing the feel for your swing and you're not sure what's happening. But again, to his incredible credit, and to his manager at the time, Chubby Chandler, that what they did was, Rory had that collapse in the Masters, but they got back on the horse straight away. I think he played the week after, I think in maybe the Far East somewhere. And I know he asked himself the question, rather than rather than what went wrong, he asked himself the question, what can I learn? Mm. You know, and I think in that again is just a simple shift in frame that, you know, if you ask yourself the question, what went wrong, you can just disappear down a black hole of, you know, self-loathing. But if it's what did I learn, and you think, okay, what did I learn? Yeah, I got quicker, or I got slower, or these thoughts interrupted me, or I put my attention on this. And, you know, he played the week after, and then that same year he won the US Open by a streak, by half a dozen shots. And that was a great testimony. And I think very often in sport or life, we don't ask ourselves good questions. And if you've had a setback, and, you know, if you ask the question, why me, or what's wrong with me, well, those are dangerous routes. But if it's what did I learn, what will I do differently next time, those really bad experiences can actually be gold. I think if you look at a lot of successful businessmen and women, they've had failures. You know, they've gone bust, or they've had one company that didn't work out. But I think the ones who come back ask the good questions. What did I learn from this? What did I learn from that experience that actually has made me stronger, that I'll come back with, armed with that information? You know, because failure can give some incredibly powerful feedback. You know, I've done thousands of presentations over the years in the days when we could speak to live audiences. But I look back on them, and it's not just about, it's not focusing on the failures, but I think that you know, understanding what when something hasn't gone well, the details of that, you know, in terms of presentations, I now know so much about setting the route, how you need to set the environment up, and how you start and how you finish and things like that. So it's those little details that if you ask the right questions after a failure, you can move on from. But if the question is what's wrong with me, then
it's absolutely fascinating that reframing that question away from, which is something I've put myself into a terrible place recently, because I didn't ask myself the right questions. Instead of saying, well, why did I fail? Actually, what can I learn? That's so fascinating.
Yeah, and again, things like, you know, what was really valuable about this experience? Then all of a sudden, the bad experience is reframed. And, you know, this is where again, I think things like meditation and mindfulness can be powerful, because, you know, essentially when you meditate, you sit down and you decide to pay attention to your breath. But then you notice what your mind does. You notice its patterns. You notice the tricks that the mind plays on. You notice the stories that it goes to. And I think that would be one strong message. You know, am I perfect at it? No, I'm not. But it's this idea that when you can observe your patterns, when you can observe your own tendencies, then you can really, really learn from that and move on from it. And, you know, my meditation teacher always talks about the idea, with the big part about meditation is the attitude that you bring to it. So rather than if you've had a bad meditation session, whatever that is, and your mind's off on one and getting lost, if you go, oh, I can't meditate, I'm useless at this, well, again, that's not leading anywhere. But if there's a curiosity to it, okay, that was interesting, what happened then, where was I, what did my mind actually do? Be curious about your own patterns and habits, because then curiosity leads somewhere, whereas labeling doesn't. You know, I'm useless, I can't do this, I'm hopeless, and all of those sort of permanent labels that I think when we've all suffered from depressive thinking, that's the way that we tend to go.
It's very interesting, something I need to take away.
You get that for free, that one.
Fantastic. High pressure rounds of golf, you mentioned it actually earlier, and to be honest, we've begun speaking about it, but this is highly transferable outside of golf, outside of sport, into everyday life. But there's a similarity here, which is high pressure rounds of golf, whether it's majors, Ryder Cups, etc., golfers go through an incredible range of emotions, both up and down. Like, how do they begin to cope with with those emotions, not letting them take over. What techniques do golfers use to think clearly? Obviously, this might come back around to meditation and being present again.
Well, I think the other thing that they would do, James, and again, you know, you can look at other high pressure situations to see how the mind can not be controlled, because I think that's not a useful way of looking at this, because you will always have thoughts popping into your head. You'll always have situations where you feel uneasy. But you know, in the military, they talk about SOP, don't they? You know, standard operating procedure, that when you're in literally a life or death situation, that you know that to the best of your ability, if you do these things, you're giving yourself the best possible chance. There's a procedure that you go through. You know, pilots do that. Surgeons in critical life situations have a procedure that they can hang on to give themselves the best chance. And, you know, in golf and all sports, really, Johnny Wilkinson would be a good example with his kicking in rugby. I think Owen Farrell would be another one. I think what really good players do is have a kind of process that they go through, call it a ritual, a routine, or whatever. That, you know, on this particular shot, if I do this, this, and this, well, then I can't guarantee that the shot's going to be successful, but at least I'm giving myself the best possible chance. You know, famously, one of the players that I worked with who won the Open at St. Andrews, Louis Oosthuizen, he'd never made a cut in a major championship. And we got together and talked about a few things, and, you know, extremely long story short, one of the things that we came up with, because he talked about his inability to focus, was the idea that on every shot that he played, what he was going to do was he had a red dot on his glove, and as he looked at that red dot was just a trigger to then do a couple of things in his routine. And that was the whole goal that week at St. Andrews. Just look at the dot, go through your routine, deal with the outcome. That's, you know, nice. And he went on to, he led in the first round, and all the experts were saying there was no way he could keep going for four rounds, but he did. And, you know, he won by, I think, seven shots in the end, and won his first major at the Home of Golf at St. Andrews, you know. So,
and that red dot really is hypnosis at the end.
Yeah, and it's an attentional trigger. It's basically telling yourself, and you could apply that principle in so many ways, that, you know, when you walk in your office, you know, be aware of what that environment's triggering for you. If you walk into your office and, excuse the language, it's an absolute shit heap, well, that office is telling you that you've got a very chaotic mind. Well, if you've got a very chaotic mind, good luck in organizing good days, you know. Whereas if, I'm not saying everything has to be minimalist and nothing in there and everything perfect, but be aware of how your environment will trigger your behavior.
Yes.
You know, what are the pictures on the walls, and what are the messages, and what are the things that you look at the most, because they will influence you. I know you've talked with John Barge about these kind of things, about how the environment can trigger behavior. And, you know, Louis' red dot on the glove, did that make him win the Open? No, but what it did do is it allowed him to know that he had a process to follow that would give him the best possible chance. So you can have all this chaos going on, you can have a lot of noise, but if you have a process that to stick to, that you know you can trust, you know, I don't know Johnny Wilkinson personally, but I, you know, looking at the way he performed under pressure, he seemed to be pretty, you know, absorbed in his ritual of this kick in this moment. You know, when people see Johnny doing that with his hands and going through, you know, it might look a bit strange, but my goodness, that's a useful thing to be able to do, because he's practiced that over and over and over again. So his brain just thinks, this is just another kick. It might be for the World Cup, but he's conditioned to go through a series of steps to release his capability. You know, I think Dave Brailsford had the saying with the cycling team in all the Olympic successes over the years, it's just another day in Manchester, in the sense that wherever they were, that the, you know, they trained in Manchester, and the training was of such good quality that wherever they were, World Championships or Olympics, it was just another day in Manchester. So they were conditioned to the nth degree to expect anything from their environment, and then you get on with it and deal with it.
Fascinating. You're working a lot with corporates now, I think, and companies to look at training programs. What exactly are you doing?
It's a similar thing with that you would do with a golfer, James, really. It's no different than you go in there and say, well, okay, what's the objective? What are you trying to achieve? What's the interference like? What's going on with your staff? What training do they perhaps need? What training do you need as the head of this business? Because, you know, being the head of a corporation, it can be a lonely place. And I think sometimes, hopefully, that's the value that somebody like me might bring, is that leader, they can have a mirror held up and sort of say, well, what's actually going on? Because, you know, we don't see the environment because we see it every day, so we just become habituated to it. So I think if that's any value, that it's just asking some relatively simple questions, but the answers to those questions can have profound results, really. Mm. And we don't ask the questions ourselves when we're in the system. You know, I've often been fond of saying you can't see the system when you're in the system.
Fascinating hour. It's one of those hours where take away so much for myself as well. So thank you for your time. Where can people find you on social media? Obviously, you are running your own corporate business, helping corporates and companies deliver a result. So if there's anybody listening who wants to listen to your own podcast, which is the Brain Booster podcast, which is fantastic as well.
Yeah, there's the Brain Booster podcast that comes out each week. My website is it's called themindfactor.com. I think probably of interest in terms of what we've been talking about at the moment. We're currently running a mindfulness practitioner certification that's been incredible, really, during this time. We run a couple of courses and it's a relatively small group, but it's worked incredibly well. We do it over a 4-week period, so if anybody's interested in that, they can, as I say, just go to the website themindfactor.com and they can get in touch there and drop us an email and we'll see how we can help.
I might be interested myself, actually.
So really good. Really very, very awesome. Good
Carl, thank you again. Thanks so much.
Hope the recordings work this time, James.
Let's hope. We can't do it a third time.
A lot of fun. Thank you.
Take care.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening and supporting the podcast. Please subscribe if you haven't already and find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter and LinkedIn through @TheRutPod for more updates on who's coming up next on the show. Special thanks to my team, Ricky Batchu and Phil Bateman, to help me produce The Rut. Next time on The Rut, I sit down with former hockey international and Sky Sports presenter Nick Rothwell for an absolute belter of an episode. See you then.